Welcome to Clause 8, the voice of IP. Clause 8 is part of IP Watchdog and sponsored by my firm, Herity & Herity, the go-to firm for the PAN 300 for PAN preparation and prosecution. Today, we're lucky to be joined by Chris Agarwal, a partner at Bukoff McCantors. He's responsible for one of the biggest PAN deals in history. He's a top attorney and trust advisor for growth stage companies, and is a president of the Association of Intellectual Property Firms. So full disclosure before we begin, Chris is actually the reason that I, for better or worse, got into patent law. And out of all the guests, he's been the hardest to get to come on to Clause 8. So thank you for joining.
Eli, it's my absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So the question I guess I'll start with is, do you remember when you first learned about patents?
So I do remember when I first heard about IP, because it was actually very, very early on in my career. Actually, before my career, I was actually a high school senior at the time, and I was applying to colleges, and I was looking at engineering schools, and randomly, just because I liked DC, I was looking at GW, and I saw that GW had this program called Integrated Engineering and Law Program. It was a seven-year program that combined engineering school, 4 years of engineering school, with 3 years of law school. And my initial reaction was, what's that for? And then I realized it was for IP to become a patent lawyer. And that was actually the moment I realized I wanted to be a patent lawyer. So it was really, really early. And I know that's annoying to people who spend lots of time trying to figure out what they want to do in life, but I figured it out immediately. It was like this aha moment. The moment I saw that program, I realized that this was just like the perfect career for me, and I haven't looked back.
That's funny, because actually the way I learned about patents was because of a program you planned for, that Integrated Engineering and Law program, to do that visit with a boutique IP firm. So once you got to undergrad, like, what was your exposure to patent law and the field?
So in undergrad, I actually had an expectation that this program was going to be this really involved IP, you know, like a seven-year IP program. And it turned out that it was really more of 4 years of engineering and then 3 years of law school. And so, I mean, I liked engineering school a lot, but I really, really quickly wanted to get involved in IP. So I started working for a couple of different patent firms down in, or at the time it was Crystal City, right where the patent office was at the time. So I started doing patent searching, started getting involved in the field a bit. I was doing patentability searches basically while I was, you know, I would go to engineering school during the day, and then I would start, you know, go work for these firms and do patent searching. So patentability searches, clearance searches, diligence searches. It was just really, really interesting. So I got my feet wet in IP really, really early. You know, most people are, you know, they go to engineering school, then they maybe work in the field for a little bit, and then they go to law school. I just right away started doing patent searching and really loved it.
Before you even had an engineering degree, you were doing patent searching and kind of the patent work. So what was that like, I guess, for somebody who hasn't done the searching themselves? What does that kind of process involve?
So at the time, there was actually a public search room in the patent office where it was basically like a library or like a reading room. And it was filled with these terminals that the patent office put out there for people, for the public, members of the public, for professional searchers to use to do searches. This was pre-Google patents, and so there wasn't really a good way to search patents on the internet. And so I would actually go into this public search room and use the examiner's tool called EAST. And I basically did it through all of college. As a college student, you know, I was making like $25 an hour or something, and I realized that they were billing me out at like over 100. I was, you know, as a cocky 18-year-old, I was like, I could do this. So I started my own searching company really, really early on to set up a website and a company, and just started patent searching for law firms and companies. And it was a really good business. It was a lot of fun.
How did clients find you? Just Googling on the internet, or how did...
Yeah. I mean, I advertised on the internet, actually. It's really unusual, I guess. Well, I guess it's not. At the time, I mean, Google AdWords was kind of early, so I used Google AdWords. Like, I advertised on Google.
Yeah.
I did some email marketing. You know, I was probably one of the annoying people who emails you, like, hey, can you use me for patent searching? So I was doing email marketing. I think I even sent out letters to firms.
Oh, wow.
Saying, you know, like physical letters. I would just mail them out and say, you know, here, will you use my patent searching company? I would send out coupons and stuff. I actually hadn't thought about it in a long time, but it was pretty pre-internet in some ways.
So did somebody show you how to do those initial searches, or did you have to kind of figure it around?
Well, kind of. I mean, I was trained a little bit, but it was a lot of just, you know, like all patent law, it was a lot of just on the job training. And so that public search room was an interesting place. I mean, there were about maybe 50 to 100 of these weathered patent searchers who had been there, you know, they had been working there for 100 or so years, and they would all kind of help each other.
It's good those veterans were happy to help you instead of being annoyed by your trying to stick their business with your new internet methods.
They were probably annoyed too. See, the other half of that business, I was just remembering what that was like, was file histories at the time were not electronic. And so connected to the search room was a room where you could order prosecution file histories, and they would bring the file history to you. And there was a room full of copy machines.
Yeah.
Where you could just make copies. And so that was the other half of the business, was just photocopying file histories, you know, patent file histories. So, you know, you get an order from a patent firm that was, maybe they were doing, you know, litigation or maybe writing an opinion on something, or who knows what happened. They needed the file history. They would just place the order. And sometimes you'd have to wait, you know, a few days for the patent office to go find the file history. And then we would have to copy it. And then we would literally mail it to the attorney. Or sometimes scan it and email it.
So it's funny, these law firms and these clients, they just found somebody on the internet, or they just got an email, and it's like some college student, and they're like, all right, let me try asking him to help me with my important legal matters.
And I actually, I mean, one of my customers at the time was actually a big pharmaceutical company. And I don't know how they found me or why they started working with me, but yeah, it was pretty cool.
That's amazing.
But that's the beauty of the internet. You know, I could set up a business and make it work.
Yeah. So it seems like your searching business was going really well. Did you ever think, all right, I should just try to make this into a bigger business and hire all these other searchers who are in the room? Or
I kind of thought about it, but I did always, you know, because I was in that 7-year program at GW, I did always kind of have an idea that I would go to law school, that I wanted to be an attorney. So even though maybe I thought for a little bit I would keep that business going, perhaps, I knew I would definitely go to law school and become an attorney. But yeah, it was going well, and I didn't do a lot of it, but it was great business for a college kid. And interestingly, the file histories made more money than searching. You would think it would be the other way around, but actually photocopying old IDSs out of a file made more money per hour than searching. So it was really tempting to keep that going.
Your first year of law school, you worked as an examiner, then you did get that job at a big law firm at Finnegan. And before long, you were working on a $1 billion deal, growing a portfolio and helping sell that portfolio. And this was sometime around 2010.
Yeah, these were cases that had priority dates dating back to 2001, 2000, in some cases, 99. Prosecuting those cases was almost like looking back in time in a way, but with the hindsight of being able to have seen what happened in the market. In 2006, 2007, I was prosecuting cases that clearly, you know, I thought disclosed things that ultimately started being commercialized by other businesses to great success. These became really gigantic products that were running Silicon Valley. And it was funny also because I think, you know, maybe most patent attorneys would want to be working on the newest, hottest thing in terms of the client itself, and might have said, well, I want to go, you know, work on the Google or Facebook patents. I actually thought it was really, really fun and interesting to be working on these assets that were 10 years old, where so much had changed in the market in the time.
Before we go to that, I mean, what was it like dealing with the examiners? Because, you know, they're looking at this, they know it exists, but they have to kind of take themselves back 10 years.
Yeah.
What's that experience like, kind of trying to communicate that to examiners?
Yeah, it's a common. I mean, I've had that issue happen, you know, just the other day as well. It's really, really fun to prosecute a portfolio that is now 10 or 15 years old, where you've got continuations pending, you're still in the patent office mining a really, really valuable portfolio. My experience then, as is now, because actually right now I'm prosecuting something kind of similar actually, is that examiners get nervous if they're smart. The good ones who know what they're doing get nervous because they know that they're examining something for one company that has since become really, really commercially relevant for another. And they get nervous that they're going to make a mistake, that they're going to allow a patent that all of a sudden has many billions of dollars of infringing revenue. And so it's almost like they know it's true, but they don't want it to be true, or they're nervous that the claims that they're going to allow are too broad. So I think they always give us the priority date. I mean, there's never a question about whether we're entitled to that. And I don't so much have the issue of them using hindsight or having really trouble picturing what it was like 10 years ago. It's more of they know they're supposed to go back 10 years. They can do it, but they're just very hesitant. And so, especially these days, this wasn't so much an issue of prosecuting the portfolio than, you know, 2006, 2007 timeframe, but more now is examiners will sometimes use 101 as the way to deal with that discomfort of prosecuting a portfolio that feels very valuable and scary to them.
And you do hear from examiners from time to time, like, I don't want to end up in the newspaper or something like that. Mm-hmm. Even though statistically, I don't know if it's one out of a million or one. But yeah, that's funny. So I guess this is another question. In terms of you go working from these individual matters to kind of thinking of a portfolio holistically, how does that perspective change? I know you mentioned, you know, filing a lot of continuations obviously is a good strategy if you have applications that you think might be valuable. So you know what might happen in the future. But I guess, how does your thinking change going from those individual matters to more of this is a portfolio of matters?
Well, the first place I start is looking at the business. What does the business look like today? And what do they need first and foremost? So
yeah,
thinking about, has the business changed over time? Can we shift the patent portfolio to make sure that we're first and foremost covering our core products and services? First, start off by having a defensive posture, making sure that we're covering our core products, that we've got, you know, countersuit assets there. And then it really depends on the company. So it's very, very company specific. For a small company, we'll often look really, really closely at competitors, you know, for small and mid-sized companies, and start looking at competitors and start looking at drafting claims on competitors. And then from there, start looking at more of the nice to haves. Can we also cover this other industry? Is there something else where there's real revenue, but it's really not connected to our business, where we could turn the portfolio itself into an asset kind of separate from our business? And I think we generally don't push the limits too far. You know, a lot of the troll litigation, you see them really pushing the boundaries of a specification.
Yeah.
I typically find that doesn't work too well. You know, when you take just a really, really kind of bare bones spec and come up with some wild theories about how it reads on some new industry, and you can tell when you read the spec they had no clue what they were doing.
Yeah.
I don't do that typically. You know, you look at the spec and see what was there, what did they have in mind, what is our company product, what are we making and selling, what would be of value to us, and then you just keep zooming out. You know, what does the industry look like, how have things changed?
All right, so let's go back to that, I guess, the big sale. I'm interested in the process of how these things happen. And you think you have these valuable patents. Walk me through, I guess, how do you think about monetizing this?
So in general, the process looks like for all deals like this, you start to map out the market. And I think the first place you look at with any deal is who are the infringers? What does the market look like for these claims? Who needs the claims, who's practicing the claims, and what does that market look like? So you start mapping out just across the portfolio, who's practicing various things, who are the big players. You look not only at the claims and who's practicing the claims, but also just who is in need of a portfolio like this.
How do you figure out that piece? Like, who's in need of a portfolio?
Well, I think that's happened. It's happened almost kind of publicly a number of times throughout the last 20 years, where you start to hear about or you see a company that's growing really, really quickly, and they're just behind on the patent game in general. You know, so it's happened a number of times. There have been, you know, it happened really, really early on in the smartphone. Well, even, you know, before that, there have been lots of examples throughout history. But in my career, in the smartphone wars in the, 2006, 2007 timeframe.
Yeah.
And then it's continued to happen a number of times, I think, kind of obviously. I mean, it happened a bit with ride sharing. It's happening again with electric vehicles and so on. There's always these moments in technology where a company moves really, really quickly and then finds themselves in need of a nice patent arsenal. And at the time, this was pre-Alice, and patents were really, really valuable at that time. Also, by the way, pre-PTAB, it was pre-AIA. So that was kind of, I would say, like the high watermark of patent value, both in terms of individual patents, like on a per patent basis at some level, but also the ability to just kind of look out at the market and see who needs patents, who doesn't. It was a busy, liquid market for patents.
Yeah.
There were lots and lots of patent brokers, buyer's agents, seller's agents, lots of deals going. Pretty much all of the major operating companies were buying or selling different parts of their portfolio. I mean, I was even working at the time with a large company that was just divesting parts of its portfolio, because that was also happening. I mean, there was such a market for patent that you could also just look at your portfolio and say, what do we need? What do we not need based on where our business is going? Can we take this chunk of our portfolio? And even though we know, we're not practicing this, can we spin it as, well, this is really relevant to this new area of telecom or something like that, to try to sell it. And that was happening at that time. You could actually sell off part of your portfolio in a way that I think is much, much harder to do these days.
What is it like these days? How is it compared?
The AIA, the PTAB, and 101 all together, a lot of your prior guests have talked at length about, have all conspired together to make it just a tougher market for patents. Each individual patent is worth a bit less. It's easier to challenge and kill patents in the PTAB. It seems like there has now developed this kind of rule of thumb about the most you'd pay for certain types of patents, depending on how easy it is to kill them, how much it costs to kill them in the PTAB. It's added a bit of a chilling effect to the patent market. And then also the litigation landscape, I think, has made companies less eager to build up defensive postures the way they were, 10, 15 years ago.
Obviously, we still see what you were describing. For example, when Uber and Twitter were about to go public, they acquired patents from IBM. You see that kind of what you're describing, but I guess it's probably less of a pressing need now than it was 10 years ago. Do you think the mindset kind of shifted about?
I do. I think it's less so. I think that's a fair statement. I think you can see from their activity, though, that there's still a demand for patents. All of these big companies are still arming themselves as they approach IPOs.
Yeah.
And just as they grow in general, they'll still grow. And I talk to companies about this sometimes. I talk with clients about it. There are companies that try to resist, and you've seen it too, Eli, right? There are companies that try to resist the patent world. At the end of the day, they're important, not just for countersuits, but for demonstrating to the market that you're a tech company, to showing what you're doing to your customers and to your partners. So there are a lot of really important reasons to develop a patent portfolio. And I'm often talking to clients about the importance of building them, obviously, even though I'm biased, obviously.
So actually, that's what leads me to my next topic. So you've talked about these companies who are, they're doing really well, so well that they kind of forget to think about their patent program. And before you know it, they kind of are in a position where they either need to acquire patents or, take some other action. When do you start thinking about patents? And let's assume you're not a tech-heavy field, so you're not spending billions of dollars on research and development. Let's say, I guess an example, some e-commerce company or something like that. When do you start thinking about your patent program or your patent portfolio and so forth?
Well, we always recommend starting early Eli, just because timing is so, so important in the patent world. The market moves so quickly that if you wait, your competitors do pop up and start filing. So yeah, I always recommend at least thinking about it early and at least getting kind of a core full application on file. We call it an omnibus application or a catch-up application. We kind of do an audit and say, let's look at where we are, what we've done so far, and try to catch up all of that material and get kind of as solid of a technical disclosure as we can for our our business or our products into the patent office.
You can't play catch up and fake it at a later point in time. It's not like, you know, you're starting a startup and you're like, all right, I'm not going to worry about it now. I'll worry about it in a year and my patent attorney will figure out how to kind of catch up, even though we haven't been filing applications. And if you don't file a patent application, somebody else is probably going to file a patent application.
That's what tends to happen. Yeah. I mean, there's usually not just one company in the field. And so, yeah, if you don't file, someone else will. The other thing I've seen happen is sometimes there's a risk to just getting a quick provisional on file. You know, a lot of times you'll see a startup just do a quick provisional and then just wait a year. And I've seen that not go well as well. People will often, the year goes by and it flies by always, right? The year flies by, everything changes so much. And then you go back and look at what was a quote unquote quick provisional, and it's rarely as much as you wanted it to be.
Let's say there's a startup founder who's listening to this and he's like, damn it, I'm already behind. I need to find a patent attorney right away. What advice would you give? How do you find the right patent attorney? What are the questions, I guess, to ask?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. And it's a notoriously difficult one. I know a lot of your guests have commented on the fact that finding a lawyer is really hard. And I totally echo that. I think finding a good patent attorney is really hard. Shopping for legal services is hard. I think the best thing to do is to work your network and try to talk to other companies who've had success with their patent attorneys. Unfortunately, it's just one of the best ways still to find good legal services through referrals, because all of these other indicia of, you know, quality legal representation, like where you went to school or how big is the firm, they really don't hold up. You need to try to get a hold of someone who your friends, colleagues, coworkers have had success with. So once you get in touch with someone, I recommend just asking a lot of questions about what the company should do. What should the strategy be? Find out things like their experience. Have they worked with companies like your company, obviously outside of the conflict space, but companies that are similarly situated in size, type of technology. I would try to get a sense of fee structure and find a firm that's going to be reasonable in fees that will allow the attorney to really learn the business, learn the technology, really dig in and partner with the company, come up with a filing strategy. I think that those are some of the key things.
That's good advice. Let's say a client comes to you and you agree to take them on as a client. You've talked about like what kind of things you think about, you know, obviously when you're dealing with a company, but how do you set the expectations? They've read about you. They read that you sold a portfolio for $1 billion. They're like, all right, Chris, get to work, make us $1 billion. And also the other side is obviously, you mentioned that the Ellis issues, you know, depending on the field they are, it's a bit unpredictable about what might happen down the line. I guess, how do you set the expectations for the company and in the short term and long term?
Occasionally a client or prospective client will ask me with a lot of hesitation or anxiety about, are we going to get a patent here? Is this possible?
Yeah.
With that, I'm not in expectation setting mode. I'm always saying, you know, I'm in.
So that's a good position.
Yeah. I'm always saying, you know, we're going to get a patent. The question here is breadth and time. And those two things fight against each other. It's easy to get a narrow patent really quickly. It's easy relatively to get a broad patent after many, many years of fighting with the patent office. But one of the most important things to do is figure out where the company is risk and timing wise and value wise and figure out where as a patent attorney to aim in the time versus breadth evaluation. But in terms of setting expectations, I absolutely do talk with clients really candidly about how long the patent process takes, how much it costs, what patents can be used for and what they can't. Usually expectation setting is not a problem because we get what we want. You know, 90% of the time we're getting really, really good patents as we go along through that process.
If you're a big company and you file a lot of patent applications, you might get a lot of different R units, a lot of different examiners. And overall, you'll have a decent outcome. But for a startup, you can really get stuck with a bad examiner or a bad R unit, right? Is that an issue you come across?
We absolutely have this. Well, there's huge variation across the patent office in, you know, as you've talked with a lot of folks in the industry about in patent quality, you know, quote unquote, or examination quality. Claim breadth that's possible to get out of the patent office or 101, whether it's even applied at all or not. And if it is applied, how strictly is it applied? There's huge, huge variation from tech center to tech center, from art unit to art unit, from examiner to examiner. And you're exactly right that a small company, fortunes in the patent office can be massively impacted by which examiner they're assigned to. That is one of the reasons why we rarely file just one application and just wait for, you know, 18 months.
Right.
So I guess that is part of the expectation setting. That is one of the things we talk about with startups early on. So that's why, you know, that example that I mentioned a moment ago, we kind of looked at all of their products, their services, and filed a suite of half a dozen different filings to try to cover a lot of different aspects of their business so that no one examiner holds all the cards. Sometimes even with a single filing, we'll end up filing many continuation applications that end up getting spread out across the patent office. And so you'll get some variation in examination quality and claim scope across the patent office. I also don't necessarily buy into just getting, you know, trying to find a quote unquote easy examiner and trying to get the broadest claims ever. I actually think there's a lot of value in having a variety of examiners. You get different searches, you get different claim scope.
Yeah.
I like getting some variation in claim scope.
Yeah. But I think that's a really good piece of advice. Don't just file one single patent application.
Especially don't just file one application and then wait 2 years. Sometimes we'll file, you know, 3, 4, 12 or more for a startup to really get a good foothold in the patent office. And so we immediately start getting some office actions back and start figuring out where we want to be in the patent office.
That's really good advice. And then you could adjust your strategy as well.
Right.
So I guess, you know, let's say you have this company that you file these, maybe you can call them foundational patent applications, and the company grows. How do you scale the patent program within that company, within that client? How do you kind of build that rhythm?
Well, this is something we do a lot of. It's from years of assisting kind of the full spectrum of companies from, you know, very small to very, very large. And so, you know, we see the kind of full spectrum of patent programs, what they look like, how formal they are, and what works and doesn't work. Because in a patent program, size and formality does not always mean better. So we've kind of seen what works and doesn't work and try to put together a patent program that works for the company where they are, the bandwidth that they have internally in the legal team, if there is a legal team. And then probably most importantly, we will do, you know, a feedback loop on it and update it and help it grow with the company. But it usually starts off with, you know, with a very, very small company with things like putting together an invention disclosure form, putting together, you know, a patents 101 or intro to patents program, putting together a best practices cheat sheet for, you know, if there's an in-house lawyer or tech CTO or someone to reference of, you know, what to do, what not to do with patents. And just having some of these key documents at hand present to the company so that everyone has some baseline understanding of patents and what are some best practices. And then we start to layer on things from there based on the size of the company. So as the company gets bigger, we start putting in place things like checklist for evaluating invention disclosure forms, maybe a patent committee internally, sometimes also including myself or someone from our firm so that we can help evaluate the patent and just kind of going from there. But putting together, you know, everything from kind of a small program to a really large program where you have a weekly meeting, status check-ins, kind of formal rubric of how to evaluate inventions, how to evaluate filings, how to decide what filings you keep or kill, kind of mapping a growing portfolio to the company.
Is there a good time to start thinking of bringing on somebody full-time to focus on patents? Is there something, I guess, obviously, you know, if it's taking up all of your time and the general counsel, obviously makes sense. But besides that, what do you think might be kind of an indicator of that?
I think it's when either the general counsel or CEO or CTO or whoever it is who's managing it believes that some of these decisions should be made in-house and has gotten to the point where it's too many decisions for them to handle, or they just personally have insufficient interest in it, but still believe that they need someone who's integrated in the business, who's, you know, on site or really integrated into the product teams or tech teams, or someone who's in it, who can make all the decisions. I'm not going to say, you know, there's not a company size, there's not a portfolio size. To me, it's really when that person gets to the point where they think these decisions have to be made in-house, but they don't have the bandwidth or interest in it.
What about from a cost perspective? And obviously you said different companies think about it differently, but in terms of you're trying to contain your IP costs, do you think that kind of plays into it?
I don't think so, actually, because I think there's this fallacy, and a lot of folks have seen this happen, where there's this assumption that, oh, well, once your outside legal spend for IP gets to some certain dollar value, let's just say, for example, you're spending, you know, $200,000 or $300,000 a year on outside counsel. It's just not true that, oh, you can just hire someone in-house and that spend goes away. It can't be a cost-motivated decision. I think it has to be a strategy where you realize that you really need someone who's integrated in the company, who really, really knows what's going on inside the company because of the size of the company, and it's just not motivated by cost.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned your firm obviously sees a lot of different patent programs. You have clients who approach things differently in terms of wanting to be super hands-on involved with every decision or kind of trusting you to do that. I mean, overall, I guess, what do you see that in-house counsel does right, or what do you think some in-house counsel should consider doing differently?
I really like it when in-house counsel takes an interest in the IP. You know, I really like it when they're involved and participate in these, you know, so we really, really often do these weekly or monthly calls with most of our clients. And I really like it when they get involved. They want to know what's going on with their portfolio. They bring us into the business a bit and tell us what's going on with their business and really kind of guide us in a collaborative way, but also trust us. You know, I think one of the things to do, and honestly, all of our clients do this because I think it's just too hard not to, but you have to at some level, kind of like I was saying before, you have to hire good people and then trust them to take it the rest of the way. Just as an example, we do a lot of interviewing examiners. As you know, from being a really active prosecutor, there's this dance that will happen at certain points in prosecution with an examiner where you have to kind of really quickly make some decisions on the fly about how to, you know, what deals to make with an examiner, how to change scope here and there a little bit. I think ideally you want to empower your outside counsel to be able to have a little bit of leeway with examiners so that dance can happen. I think it's really powerful if you can empower your counsel to do that.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, I guess the two main things are, if your in-house counsel is to be that bridge for what's going on in the business in terms of strategy and technology to your outside counsel, but at the same time, trust them to make those day-to-day prosecution decisions.
Yeah.
So one of the themes of this podcast is we talk a lot about the different law firm models and what makes them succeed. A lot of times, you know, a startup might have already outside counsel at some law firm, and there's patent attorneys at that firm. They'll end up paying them to do their patent work. But I guess you're seeing less and less of those big firms are even doing that type of work, right?
Right, right. I mean, what happened about, well, maybe 15 years ago is the really large firms started to realize that, you know, IP litigation is where it's at for you know, high dollar work. They kind of gravitated toward just the IP litigation side of things. And while a lot of those big firms they used to do a bit of prosecution, most of them don't do much at all. I mean, I still occasionally hear about some big firms doing a bit of prosecution, but most of them have, you know, from what I understand, made a pretty conscious decision to avoid it.
And what do you think makes it hard? I guess it's just the pricing model.
I think it's two things. Yeah, I think it's the pricing model. You just can't, you know, when I was describing that, you know, the back and forth of prosecution, of negotiating with an examiner or handling the formalities of patent application, it's just very difficult to do that in a way that makes economic sense when you're dealing with big firm billing rates. Also, when you think about, you know, just what's happened with patents and patent value and, you know, depending on the size of the company, it just doesn't make sense to do that for your 500th patent in the portfolio to be paying $1,000 an hour for someone to interview a 101. It doesn't make sense. So that's the one thing, is the pricing model. The second thing is patent prosecution is just a different animal in terms of docketing and training and staffing. You know, so firms like Harrity, where you're at, and Bowmick, where I'm at, the firm is just laser focused on patent prosecution and counseling. And so all of the infrastructure of the firm, docketing, the paralegals, even accounting, and all of the attorneys, everyone's on the same page about how that case is going to work, how you docket it, how you bill for it, how you keep track of everything. And it's just a different animal. And so I think it's very, very difficult to have that culture, the culture it takes to nurture a patent file. I think it's difficult to set up that culture within a gigantic firm that most of the time is dealing with gigantic litigations or huge deals.
So you're actually the president, as I mentioned, of the Association of Intellectual Property Firms. You became president at an interesting time, right?
That's right.
Right before the pandemic or right after? What was it?
It was during. Yeah, it was during.
During. If you could think back, we started this conversation about thinking back in terms of technology, but thinking back, I guess, what were the issues do you think, and the organizations made up of firms around the world, but what do you think of the issues that they were thinking about?
So first of all, just as a little bit more background, so AIPF is an international association of firms that dedicate the majority of their practice to IP. So, you know, basically at least half of their practice has to be IP to be a member. It tends to be more of the type of boutique that I mentioned. It's firms like Bowmick and Harrity. And I'm really excited, by the way, that you let me know that Harrity is going to be joining AIPF. I'm just thrilled that you've committed to that during this podcast, Eli. But it's a lot of members, just like firms like ours, where it's kind of that middle tier of boutiques, that, you know, mid-size and small patent boutiques that mainly focus on IP. The whole idea of the association, and it's a collegial kind of intimate association, the whole idea is for us to share information about running an IP firm, the issues that you come across in running an IP firm. And a lot of the things that we were focused on before the pandemic were some of the things that I mentioned a moment ago: docketing, paralegals, hiring and retention, pricing, and, you know, real estate. And it was interesting when the pandemic hit, it was like all of those issues were on steroids. You know, all of a sudden overnight, all of those issues became really, really important. We went from talking about how are you going to select and build out your office to what are you doing with your office? How are you getting your people out of the office? You know, we went from how are you hiring and retaining people to how are you retaining and motivating people remotely? So it was in some ways a big change, but also kind of just more of the same, but on steroids. And I was really thankful to have the association because we were all talking with each other and sharing information about what we were doing. And so it was really helpful. You know, as the pandemic was hitting in late February and early March of 2020, we were talking to each other about, you know, what we were seeing internationally from our clients, from other firms. Have you seen a drop in business? Are you getting phone calls? What are you doing? What are you preparing for? And so it's just a really nice network of people to lean on to find out, you know, what's going on with other firms like yours.
Hopefully not, but let's say there's another pandemic in 50 years or so. Are there any traits or characteristics of firms that you think kind of were able to handle it better than others?
One of the things that all of our members talked a lot about is how in March and April of 2020, there was this huge concern, fear. There was some panic, you know, in March and April, and there were firms trying to figure out what to do, clients calling up saying, hold on to things. But then really quickly, I mean, I think most of our member firms, and our firm saw too, I think yours probably did as well, that really, really quickly tech companies, you know, clients of IP firms did really well. I mean, a lot of them came out of this pretty well, and it kind of did show that the tech world, the IP world, is not a cross-section of the whole world, you know. So we're really fortunate that a lot of tech companies and IP clients and IP firms have been really, really disproportionately fortunate to still be thriving and growing right now when a lot of people are suffering. But as far as the difference between different types of firms, I think there are a couple of things. One is obviously firms that were already paperless, at least, you know, at least paperless. You didn't have to have a strong remote culture, but if you were at least paperless, you certainly had an easier March of 2020 than firms that weren't. Almost all of the members that I talked to were already paperless. Most patent offices around the world had already gone paperless. Like you and I talked about earlier, you know, the patent office had gone paperless. And so a lot of patent firms were already really nicely set up for remote, well, for at least paperless work. I think the second big thing is firms that had in place some kind of commitment to culture did better than the ones that didn't. So if you had, it didn't have to even be an in-office culture, but at least a commitment to preserving culture, then you did better probably than the firms that kind of took it for granted or relied exclusively on just the fact that you were, you know, showing up to the same office every day. And that was actually, by the way, part of our programming for AIPF. I mean, one of the things we talked about among members a lot and had a bit of programming on is, you know, what do you do to keep people engaged and motivated? What are some things you're doing? You know, so we would talk about, you know, Zoom events and what different types of things you can do to preserve culture within a patent firm during all of this. Firms that had a commitment to that and tried to keep doing it have fared a lot better. And it's interesting. I'm just starting to hear, I mean, we're a year in. I think it's actually now that I'm starting to hear more stories of attorneys and firms really having massive fatigue and getting to the point where some things aren't going well because, you know, for firms that haven't really worked hard on their culture. It's not easy. It's been a really challenging year for sure.
Well, I think that's good advice for the future. Go paperless and think about your firm culture.
That's right.
So since you're a fountain of wisdom for myself, I thought it's only right that I share your wisdom with others. But I guess let's start here. Somebody's listening to this and they're thinking, wow, that Chris Agarwal, he's doing really cool work. How do I become the next Chris Agarwal? Let's say a young engineering student. What advice would you give to them?
Well, I would say go for it. You know, I know a lot of folks in the legal profession are hesitant to encourage people to go into the law, but I love it. I love being a patent attorney. I really, really, truly enjoy it. And so it's no joke. You know, I decided I wanted to do it really, really early on, and I've never doubted really whether I wanted to be a patent attorney. And so if you are, you know, a student in college or in law school and you think you want to be a patent attorney, just go for it. It's a lot of fun. You get to work with a lot of cool companies, you get to work on interesting technology. It's a really great profession that's rewarding and a lot of fun. So my advice is just go for it. Come join us, be a patent attorney. The other, I guess, advice I'd have is a lot of the fortunate events that I've had have happened because I had a moment where I was a little bit maybe bold or took a chance or cocky or something. It just reached out to someone out of the blue. So I highly recommend doing that, especially when you're young. You know, once you're middle-aged or something, people will stop returning your phone calls probably. But when you're a student, people want to help you. And so you should take that moment to just reach out, find people who, you know, seem interesting and just reach out to them and find out what they're all about and get advice.
I actually give that exact advice to my younger brother.
Good.
I'm like, you're not going to be able to do this forever. All right. So next piece of advice. So you were obviously a huge superstar at Finnegan. So let's say there's a young associate. He wants to know, what should I do to succeed?
I think one of the most important things to understand when you're an attorney starting out at any firm is, you know, if you're an attorney in private practice, you have to really, really internalize that it's a service business and that it's all about relationships. The relationships part, well, actually, I mean, I think both of them have to start pretty early. I think a lot of young attorneys kind of early on might think it's just about the law, and the law is really, really important. But first and foremost, it's all about service. And so, you know, one of the things I try to do a good job of, and I think a lot of successful attorneys do this, is try to serve the people in your firm really, really well. That means everyone. I mean, everyone that you're working with, from one attorney to another, paralegals, your clients. I mean, everyone. You want to be really, really responsive and kind and hardworking with every single person that you interact with in a firm.
All right. That's good advice. And then let's say you're a mid-level associate at a big law firm and you're trying to figure out, well, what should I do in the future? What advice would you give?
I think the thing people always say when you're young, you know, in your first couple of years of working in a firm, is to just learn the craft a bit. you know, kind of focus on learning what you're doing, pay a lot of attention to the fundamentals and all that. But at all ages, especially when you're a mid-level associate, you want to start thinking about the relationship game and not just the service game. So you're hopefully starting to think about not just the clients and your relationships with them, but your relationships with other people at the firm, your friends, your colleagues, and forming good relationships with them, you know, even as a mid-level attorney, just like you and I did, Eli. You know, you want to try to form relationships with everyone you're working around.
Let's say one of your members is the managing partner of that firm comes to you and they're like, all right, I just became managing partner, but I don't know why. What should I be thinking about? What advice would you give them?
So first, join AIPS. and
they're already a member.
My advice for a new managing partner, like my advice for anyone who's in a new position, by the way, is to spend a lot of time just listening, you know, interviewing people and listening. I see clients do that to good effect also, you know, so every time one of our clients gets a new GC or head of IP, I think the best ones, I notice them. Usually I notice for a good few months, they'll spend time just asking questions and finding out what everyone thinks they should be doing. And then the decision-making starts. The plan, you know, kind of goes into action. But I think it's really wise to, whenever you're kind of in a new position of leadership, is to try to talk with as many people as you can and hear what everyone thinks.
All right, so last question. So let's say you're a general counsel at a company, small or large, and let's say you're not that interested in patents. But then one day you kind of wake up and you think, well, I've had my in-house counsel or outside counsel, and I don't know anything about patents, but I want to know that they're on top of things. What advice would you give?
I would recommend talking to those attorneys and asking for a full download. Like actually ask for a presentation, ask to be shown the portfolio and explained why do we have it? What is it for? Why did we get this? Why are we spending the money? I think good patent attorneys are able to put that together and communicate it in a really, really helpful way to a general counsel. So I think it's good to ask whether it's your in-house IP attorney or your outside counsel for an update and say, I want to know what's going on. I want to know, what are we spending money on? Why are we spending money on it? What do these patents cover? Why are we getting them? You know, what's the strategy? I think it's really important to do that check-in with your IP counsel, inside or out, every so often.
That's a really good piece of advice. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Eli.
Thank you for listening to Clause 8. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others and leave a 5-star rating. For more information, visit voiceofip.com. Or if you'd like to learn more about my firm, visit HairdyLLP.com.